ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Mate, they're taking 20-metre jumps and jumping into glass, trying to smash it.
What you're hearing there is a snippet of the unrest that's played out in Alice Springs CBD, recorded from inside the Todd Tavern. Yesterday afternoon saw a crowd of around 150 people rioting in the streets, fighting and attempting to break into the tavern. The outbreak of violence came after the funeral of an 18-year-old man who was in a vehicle rollover earlier this month. The antisocial behaviour has prompted NT authorities to declare an emergency situation and a 2-week curfew for all youth, effective from 6pm through to 6am each day. We'll head to the Northern Territory to hear what's in store for Alice Springs. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth.
I'm fed up with this appalling level of crime and antisocial behaviour. The community has had enough and so have I. Police will have the power to enforce a curfew in the Alice Springs CBD for people who are 18 years and younger. So we have 23 officers already down there through the Territory Safety Division. We'll be sending an additional 58 officers to Alice Springs. The youth curfew will run for 14 days at this stage. That will cover Easter as well as the school holiday period. It will include the entire CBD of Alice Springs. If someone is under the age of 18 and they're seen out in the town centre, they will be taken home or taken to a safe place. Kids are not safe on the street, and if they're not safe at home, they will be taken somewhere else. But enough is enough. I've heard loudly and clearly from the people of Alice Springs.
That's Northern Territory Chief Minister Eva Lawler addressing the media earlier this afternoon, announcing the details of emergency measures taken to quell violence in Alice Springs. The Territory Police Commissioner, Michael Murphy, also spoke on the situation, pointing to how locals have been affected by the violence.
Hearing the despair and some of the stories from Alice Springs residents, we saw really violent behaviour yesterday associated with the death of an 18-year-old male on the 20th of March. That's led to family feuds, and that's what erupted in Alice Springs yesterday in a couple of locations at the Todd Tavern when there was just reckless damage and violence demonstrated at the Todd Tavern. It led into another quite a serious fight where 150 people were involved armed with weapons. Our police responded to that and they were attacked. And we've seized 50 plus weapons. We've arrested 5 people so far. But the operation will be swift and we'll identify who's responsible and they'll be delivered to the court where they can answer for their behaviours and deliver of justice.
That's Northern Territory Police Commissioner Michael Murphy speaking to the media earlier today. It's been flagged that those extra police will also be staffing bottle shops in an attempt to mitigate alcohol-related violence. The Mayor of Alice Springs, Matt Patterson, said he welcomes the announcement of the curfew and additional police staffing.
Alice Springs is losing people who have been here for many years, which is the community spirit that Alice Springs is based on. Hopefully some of these announcements will go a long way to fixing that as immediate solutions.
Matt Patterson, Mayor of Alice Springs.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
An inquiry into the deaths of 25 people in the Black Summer bushfire disaster has made more than 20 recommendations to the New South Wales Rural Fire Service. The bushfire season lasted for 8 months, with a statewide emergency declared 3 times between November 2019 and January 2020, before the last fires were extinguished in March 2020. The series of inquiries and public hearings was heard over 2 years and gathered over 44,000 pages of evidence. And today, State Coroner Teresa O'Sullivan has handed down her findings and recommendations. Our reporter Hugh Hogan has been following this story. Hugh, as I mentioned, this inquiry has gathered so much information over the last 2 years. What then are some of the coroner's recommendations?
That's exactly right. As you say, very extensive 700-page report. And in that report, there are 28 recommendations. And as you mentioned before, 25 to the RFS. And a lot of them had to do with many of the firefighters that sadly died during the Black Summer. You might remember there was an air tanker that went down in the Snowy Mountains near Adaminaby fighting a fire. So a lot of the recommendations were actually in relation to how the RFS uses and communicates with air crews. Probably 6 of the recommendations related to that. So they want better communication between the RFS and air crews. They want pilots to be given all the information about the weather forecasts and everything before they leave to go and drop water on a site. And they want better risk assessments from the RFS when it comes to using aircraft and general conditions at the fire field. Some of the other recommendations were about the safety features on the fire trucks. Another couple of the tragic events that we saw in the Black Summer were firefighters actually died when their truck or their RFS vehicle either crashed or was hit by falling trees and branches. They want the RFS to investigate how they can improve truck safety from rollovers and falling branches and things like that. So 25 recommendations for the RFS, at all, a lot of them to do with communications, better systems, and some of those concrete things like upgrading safety in trucks.
So how are the people who were affected by the fires, those community members, how are they reacting today?
Yeah, so in terms of reaction today, we had some positive reaction to the recommendations from RFS members out in Tumut. However, some people did actually attend the coroner's court today to express their frustrations with how the recommendations panned out, as we might take a listen.
My name's Lionel Bucket. I'm from Barambing, Mount Tomar, an area where the Mount Wilson backburn turned into a major fire that wiped out over 200 houses and structures. Burned down a lot of my neighbours' houses, nearly killed quite a few of us. I've come to the whole 6 days of the inquiry, and it's a bit of a zero as far as doing anything about seeing that it doesn't happen again. It's 28 pages that aren't really affecting us in our situation.
It is devastating to see that these recommendations don't address the needs of communities to be better prepared for our changing climate. We need something much more specific. The coroner had an opportunity, had a week to hear from us, in which we were denied any ability to put forward witnesses to say what it was like.
The community voice, we feel, has not been heard. We had 17 affidavits by residents that were submitted. None of those were called to give oral evidence. We had 3 expert reports commissioned. None of those experts were called to give oral evidence. We're very disappointed as well that some of the critical RFS decision makers were not called to give oral evidence at the hearing.
Some of those affected by the Black Summer bushfires responding to today's coronial inquest, the handing down of the recommendations from the New South Wales coroner today. And I guess, Hugh, there's obviously some frustration there that perhaps speaks to what this inquiry actually is and what its aims were. Is that right?
That's right. So Magistrate Teresa O'Sullivan, who's the New South Wales State Coroner, did stress in her sort of preamble when she was handing down the report in her final session this morning that it's not the job of the coroner to sort of, you know, attribute blame or shift blame and things like that. The purpose of this inquiry is purely to, in minute detail, examine all 25 deaths and find out what happened and if there's anything that could have been changed to make it happen differently in the future, basically. So they have a very sort of narrow focus, if you will, which might speak to why some of the people were disappointed with how the report turned out. But she did say in her preamble that it's incredibly worrying that all the experts predict that fire seasons could get worse in the future. And in that case, the whole state as a whole needs to be much more prepared for when this might happen again.
And Hugh, what has been the response from the RFS today?
Yeah, so we just heard a couple of hours ago from RFS Commissioner Rob Rogers about the report. And he did say they're not going to comment on the recommendations at the moment. They want to have a full and thorough report into the recommendations and look at what they can do to achieve those before they comment on them. As you can imagine, this is 700 pages of intense, like, detail on every single death that occurred during that summer. So he didn't say whether he agreed or disagreed with them. He said he's going to go back, take them all on board, thoroughly investigate all the problems and opportunities, and then go forward. But he did stress that it's important to remember that we're now, you know, 4 years on from the Black Summer bushfires, and there's also been other inquiries, not coronial inquiries, but other government and different department-led inquiries. And they've already implemented a lot of the changes that were referenced in the report. So when it comes to truck safety, for instance, that I mentioned before. He did already mention they've already upgraded the trucks. The new trucks coming online have a lot better safety features, and a lot of the old ones are actively being retrofitted. So that was just one example he gave. That a lot of the recommendations in this report that's just come out today are already or have been addressed. And he'll go away and look at the recommendations and come back with a report to the community.
And so, Hugh, what happens now?
Well, what happens now? The handings are handed down to 25 recommendations for the RFS, a couple of others for agencies like the New South Wales Police and Essential Energy. Those agencies will go back, see the recommendations, and either implement them or explain why they can't implement them, I suppose.
Our reporter in Orange is Hugh Hogan. Hugh, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Anytime.
ABC Australia Wide.
Dozens of public figures, including the former federal Labor leader Kim Beazley, have written to the federal Environment Minister asking her to protect a rock art site on the Burrup Peninsula in WA's Pilbara, which forms part of a UNESCO World Heritage nomination. It's also where gas giant Woodside operates its vast Northwest Shelf project. And Tanya Plibersek's under pressure to stop an extension of the major gas project amid concerns it's damaging nearby Aboriginal rock art. Pilbara reporter Tom Robinson has this story.
On a rocky and isolated part of WA's northern coast called the Burrup Peninsula, evidence of ancient First Nations communities in the form of rock art sits next to a giant gas project.
It's remarkable in its landscapes. The red rocks, the red murder and the ocean connecting where the song lines come onto land and into the sea.
Raylene Cooper is an Indigenous activist dedicated to preserving the millions of rock carvings at the site, which some traditional owners and their supporters say are being damaged by gas emissions. The area, called Murujuga in local language, was nominated for UNESCO World Heritage status in 2022. It's also the onshore site of the Northwest Shelf gas project, operated by Woodside, and the federal government is currently assessing a proposed expansion. Elders like Tootsie Daniel have watched on with sadness as industrialisation on the peninsula grew over many years.
Murujuga country should be kept just alone as it is. Leave it there. It's there for a reason. It's there for our children, grandchildren, our next generation to view it and to look after it, to take care of it. That's our culture. That's our heritage. That's our museum. And they should leave it alone.
In an open letter addressed to Ms Plibersek, former Labor leader Kim Beazley, two former ALP WA premiers and other public figures say the proposal should be refused. Raylene Cooper is grateful for their support.
This letter that I'm supporting, it's really important. Look, there's been so much controversy going around the oil and gas industry, and I understand we have some prominent and influential individuals and organisations that are backing this letter. There is no way in the world I'd imagine it would get into such a political fight. It's fantastic to see, you know, their support, and we need more of this.
The letter, which has been seen by the ABC, was written by a group called Friends of Australian Rock Art. It says the minister has a unique responsibility to protect Australia's heritage sites.
I think it's very clear that the expansion of the gas development on the Burrup would place what is now recognised as, you know, world status heritage area under severe additional pressure.
That's Carmen Lawrence, a former WA premier who signed the letter. She says the site's World Heritage application is threatened by the impact of industrial emissions on the rock art.
Well, I know how difficult it is, particularly for an environment and heritage minister, often lined up against the resources ministers and those who would argue that this has a major economic impact both on Australia and Western Australia. The pluses and minuses, I think, very clearly weigh in favour of protection and a refusal for the expansion.
The science on this is contested. Some studies show long-term fading of the art. Woodside has run its own assessments and says arguments claiming industry has an impact are not conclusive. The WA government is running a long-term monitoring program until 2026. Woodside says it takes cultural heritage protection seriously and claims it's using reasonable and practicable measures to minimise emissions as the state's monitoring program continues, which it believes will provide certainty for how the rock art is protected in the long run. Other local leaders, like Tootsie Daniel, want the Commonwealth to take immediate action.
Just listen to us, Tanya. That's all you've got to do. and just listen to us and just follow our instructions.
A spokesperson for Tanya Plibersek says the federal government is strongly committed to protecting Murujuga's cultural heritage, and as the decision maker on the Northwest Shelf, she can't comment on the specifics of the proposal. The official traditional owner group, the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, says it's working with the state's monitoring program to investigate all plausible scenarios associated with air pollution, which could degrade the rock engravings.
Tom Robinson with that story from the Pilbara. For those in rural and remote Queensland, it can be challenging to get in to see a specialist or access a healthcare service. Wait lists are growing, the services are getting more expensive, and a lack of GPs make accessing healthcare increasingly difficult. But a bit of ingenuity and motivation is hoping to reverse that. Our reporter Scout Wallen spoke to health professionals hitting the road and taking to the skies to bring health services to the bush.
Do you think these types of initiatives save lives?
Most definitely. You've got a lot of people out there that are ticking time bombs, if you want to put it that way, that just don't know that they are.
It's a humid Wednesday morning in Moura, central Queensland, which is around 2 hours southwest of Rockhampton. I've boarded a Heart of Australia truck, which is one of a fleet of vehicles which travel to towns across Queensland to provide rural and remote patients with specialist healthcare services. Here I caught up with Dr. Rolf Gomes, who founded the organisation in 2009.
Currently we're sitting in one of our mobile cardiac clinics, which we call Heart 4, in the main street of Moura. The incredible thing is it's state-of-the-art cardiac and respiratory clinic on wheels. In fact, if you walked up the stairs onto this truck, you'd find more services than you would in my private practice in Brisbane. When we looked at last year compared to this year, we've had a 34% increase in the number of referrals. The service itself has grown quite significantly from initially three specialists to now I think we've got 33 specialists on board, and not just cardiology like myself, but a whole range of different specialists, endocrinologists, gastroenterologists, neurologists.
He says they've seen the impacts of a decline in bulk billing and rural GPs.
More and more we're having patients ring up and saying, look, how do I get an appointment on the heart truck? And when we tell them they need to have a referral from their GP, more frequently, we're hearing patients say, look, I can't get in to see a GP, or there is no GP in my town. I'm happy to not have the Medicare rebate if it means I don't have a referral, but I just would really like to get seen. And when we look at patients out here, patients who are frail, the gentleman we've just seen who's got severe Parkinson's disease and has terrible tremor, for patients like that, having to hop in a car and make a 2-3 hour trip to see a GP, it's a lot.
Now, that patient he's referring to is Daryl Zeeble.
I have restrictions on my licence that I can only drive a certain distance from home. This means that I can't even reach Rockhampton for services, and so we rely on services like this bus in the country to put us in touch with those sort of places.
Daryl has been attending the Heart of Australia's stop in Moura for years after Dr. Gomes and his team picked up an irregularity with his heart a few years ago.
Well, they sent us to Brisbane once for a further investigation, and they just couldn't have done that out here. But they picked it up here on the bus. So.
You know, by the end of today, there'd be a few patients who potentially are very lucky to have walked up those stairs onto this truck, and maybe very lucky to be alive as a result.
According to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, people living in rural and remote areas have higher rates of hospitalisations, death and injury, yet poorer access to healthcare services than people living in major cities. Now, health services conducting outreach in regional and rural Queensland is not a new phenomenon, but as the cost of health services increase, populations in the regions age and the number of bulk billing GPs decline, these initiatives are becoming increasingly invaluable. Similar to Dr. Gomes and his Heart of Australia trucks, Tim Gibson is the Queensland Director of Fly2Health. He's also a pilot and he flies allied health professionals in and out of rural communities across Queensland.
In regional Queensland, we see a lot of communities that have been waiting years on end for services like speech pathology, like occupational therapy, for people with disability. And it comes as no surprise because when you go to these communities, you don't see many health clinics or health professionals coming.
Their FIFO team services 20 communities around the state.
So we often have communities reach out saying, hey, we haven't seen a speech pathologist for insert amount of years. And that's where we start. You know, we go to those communities that are really needing our help. You know, the reason we don't operate in Brisbane is because there are wait lists, but nothing like Quilpie, nothing like Charleville, nothing like Roma. And that's why we go to these places.
Which is a sentiment Dr. Gomes agrees with.
The more we can bring the services to the doorstep, the more we can cater to those ageing populations.
That's Dr. Rolf Gomes, ending that report by Scout Wallen. And finally, here on Australia Wide, let's head to the southeastern corner of New South Wales, to a little town called Neville, where the community is very happy to see their historic local watering hole back in business. As is the case with many country towns, the local pub is more than a place to order a beer. It's an important meeting ground for the community. So when the historic Neville Hotel shut up shop 4 years ago, the effects were felt by many of those in the town. But now, with new owners and a fresh start, the reopening has brought new life back to the tiny town. Our reporter Lanny Otaway headed down to the pub to chat with the locals.
We were very disappointed like 4 years ago when the pub actually shut because it was the meeting place for the town. We just missed that social side of the pub.
Kevin Radburn has lived in Neville all his life.
The original Radburns come out in, I think it was about 1858, and we've descended from them. My grandson will be a seventh generation Radburn.
When the pub that knit the community together closed down, it didn't just mean the end of the local watering hole.
It sort of affected me a little bit with my business. I lost a few biker groups and that once the pub shut, you know, they didn't come to town.
He runs the Neville Siding, which accommodates visitors in old railway carriages, the station building and goods shed. While the bikers stopped, the cyclists kept coming.
And they'll ride from Orange out to Cargo, across to Canound, across to Cowra, and then they come over to Neville, they stay the night, come up to the pub, whereas they couldn't come up to the pub, so I used to have to run into town, get a meal, do a bit of a grog run, and look after them that way.
Cue the building cousins, Joe Bishop and Luke Simmons. They came up from the coast for a construction job late last year.
Luke and I were working just outside of Neville and staying at the Manjirima pub. And we heard this place was for sale and checked it out, thought it looked pretty good, so we thought we'd take it on.
Have you had any experience in owning or running or working in a pub before?
No, zero.
So you thought you'd just pick it up as you go along?
Yep, give it a crack.
And how is giving it a crack gone? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been challenging, but it's fun. A lot harder work than we thought.
Joe says he can't believe how busy it gets for a community of about 230 people.
We'll regularly do 70 meals on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Way more than what we thought. It's been a little surreal, to be totally honest. I didn't think even 6 months ago that I'd be sitting in Neville being a publican. It's been a bit nuts, really.
Phil and Kathy Rathbone have lived in Neville on and off for 40 years. They say people in and out of town have started flocking back.
It livens the place up. You know, it was dead before, so yeah.
What people together again?
They say they come down about three or more times a week now.
Yeah, sometimes we come down on the Friday night for our raffles and just meet other people. Of course, if the roasts start up on the Sunday, it's better to have somebody else cook your roast instead of yourself. So yeah, really, really nice to see a bit of fresh blood and a bit of fresh take on things.
One of Kevin's generations of Radburn used to own the pub. He says his great-grandfather Ambrose ran the business before the pub burnt down in 1926 and was rebuilt from the ashes in 1929. Kevin says it's a great feeling to see it open again.
Pubs today are a pretty tough business, but they've started off on the right foot. They've spent a bit of money here. They've put some locals on. They've got local girls working here. They're trying to sort of do the best by the community, and like the community is supporting, but I'm surprised, like I come up here and sometimes when they're really busy I walk in, I don't know half the people here, like it's amazing, like people are coming from all over the place, so it's just great.
Fast forward a few years and Joe Bishop's own dad has forged a relationship with the pub. Joe says his dad Bruce has spent hundreds of hours working on the building and doing the lawns.
We're naming the beer garden after him, so it's going to be Bruce's beer garden out the back.
Has he told you how it feels like for him seeing this place up and running after all the hours he put in to get it to where it is?
Yeah, he loves the place. He actually went to school at Bathurst, bought it in Bathurst from down in Bury. So he's got a bit of a connection to the area and just loves it out here himself. And he's an old farmer himself and just loves getting out on the tractor and mowing lawns.
A pub that's brought together families in the past, present and no doubt for years to come.
Reporter Lanny Otaway at the reopened Neville Pub in New South Wales. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. I hope you can join me then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.